Chapter 45. It took one shift only to prepare for the development. Rudd selected the starting point. The main haulage curved away from the shaft on 66 level. 300 feet along this tunnel, there was a chamber that had been cut out as a loco repair station, but which was now out of use. Two large batwing ventilation doors were fitted to the opening of the chamber to provide privacy, and behind them, the chief underground surveyor set up his instruments and marked out the head of the tunnel that would fly arrow straight a mile and more through the living rock to strike through the Big Dipper into the unknown. The area surrounding the head chamber was roped off and signposted with warnings. Danger. Independent blasting. The mine captains were instructed to keep their men well away, and all loco traffic was rerouted through a secondary haulage. On the doors of the chamber, another notice was fixed. Fiery mine procedure in force. No naked lights beyond this point. Owing to small deposits of coal and other organic substance in the upper stratas of rock, the Sonderditch was classed as a fiery mine and subject to the government legislation covering this subject. No matches, lighters, or other spark-generating devices were allowed into a new development end, because the presence of methane gas was always suspected. Colourless, odourless, tasteless, detectable only by test with a safety lamp, it was a real and terrifying danger. A 9% concentration in air was highly explosive. Stringent precautions were taken against accidental triggering of methane that may have oozed out of a fissure or cavity in the rock. From the main compressed air pipes running down the corners of the shaft were taken leads to air tanks in the haulage, ensuring that 60 pounds per square inch of pressure was available for the rock drills. Then drills, pinch bars, hammers, shovels, and the other tools were unloaded from the cage at 66 level and stored at the shaft head. Lastly, explosive was placed in the red lockers at the head of the development. And on the evening of October the 23rd, 1968, 30 minutes after the main blast, David Delange and his gang disembarked from the cage and went to the disused loco shop. Davy, with the surly little Swazi bus boy beside him, stood before the rock wall on which the surveyor had marked the outline of the tunnel. Behind him, his gang had fallen unbidden to their labour, each man knowing exactly what was expected of him. Already the machine boys and their assistants were lugging their ungainly tools forward. You. Davy indicated to each of them the hole on which he was to begin, and then stepped back. Shire, he commanded, hit it. And with a fluttering bellow that buffeted the eardrums, the drive began. The drilling ceased, and David charged the holes. The fuses hung like the tails of white mice from their holes, each length carefully cut to ensure correct firing sequence. Clear the drive! The boss boy's whistle shrilled, the tramp of heavy boots receding, until silence hung heavy in the chemically cleaned air. Cheeser! Davy and the boss boy, with the igniters burning like children's fireworks in their right hands, touched them to the hanging tails until the chamber was lit by the fierce blue light of the burning fuses. The shadows of the two men flickered gigantic and distorted upon the walls. All burning. Let's go. And the two men walked quickly back to where the gang waited along the haulage. The detonations sucked at their ears and thrust against their lungs, so that afterwards the silence was stunning. David checked his wristwatch. By law, there was a mandatory 30 minutes wait before anyone could go back to the face. There may be a hang fire waiting to blow the eyes out of someone's head. Even if there were not, there was still the cloud of poisonous nitrous fumes that would destroy the hair follicles in a man's nostrils and render him still more vulnerable to the fine particles of rock dust that would seek to enter his lungs. Davy waited those 30 minutes, by which time the ventilation had sucked away the fumes and dust. Then, alone, he went up the haulage. With him he carried his safety lamp, its tiny blue flame burning behind the screen of fine brass wire mesh. That mesh was flashproof and insulated the flame from any methane in the air. Standing before the raw circular wound in the rock wall, Davy tested for methane gas, watching the blue flame for the telltale cap. There was no sign of it, and satisfied he extinguished the lamp. "Boss boy!" he yelled, and the Swazi came up, uncoiling the hose behind him. "Water down!" Only when the rock face, and all the loose rubble below it, was glistening and dripping with water, was Davy satisfied that the dust was laid sufficiently to bring up his gang. "Bar boys!" he yelled, and they came up, carrying the 12-foot-long pinch bars, a tool like a giant crowbar. "Bar down, make safe." And the bar boys attacked the bunches of loose rock that were flaking and crumbling from the hanging wall. Two of them, manipulating one bar between them, with the steel point striking sparks from the rock. The dislodged fragments rained down, heavily at first, and then less and less, until the rock above their heads was solid and clean. Only then did Davy scramble over the pile of rubble to reach the face and begin marking in the shot holes. Behind him, his gang were lashing the stuff into the waiting cocoa pans, and his machine boys were dragging the drills up to the face. Davy's gang made 3 blasts that first night. As he rode up in the cage into a pink, sweet-smelling dawn, Davy was satisfied. "Perhaps tonight we will get in 4 blasts," he thought. In the company change house, he showered, running the water steaming hot so his skin turned dull, angry red, and he worked up a fat white lather of soap suds over his head and at his armpits and crotch. He rubbed down with a rough, thick towel and dressed quickly. Crossing the parking lot to his battered old Ford Anglia, he felt happy and good tired, hungry and ready for bed. He drove into Kitchenerville at a steady 40 miles an hour, and by this time the sun was just showing over the Kraal Kop Ridge. The dawn was misty rose, with long shadows against the earth, and he thought that this was how it would be in the early mornings on the farm. On the outskirts of the town, Johnny's Monaco roared past him going in the opposite direction. Johnny waved and blew the horn, shouting something that was lost in the howl of wind and motor. "They'll catch him yet," Davy shook his head in disapproval. "The speed limit is 45 along here." He parked the Anglia in the garage and let himself in through the kitchen door. The Bantu maid was busy over the stove. "3 eggs," he told her, and went through to his bedroom. He shrugged off his jacket and threw it on the bed. Then he returned to the door and glanced quickly up and down the passage. It was deserted, and there was no sound besides the clatter of the maid in the kitchen. Davy sidled into the passage. The door to Johnny's bedroom was ajar, and Davy moved quietly down to it. His heart was pounding in his throat, his breathing was stifled by his guilt and excitement. He peered around the edge of the door and gasped aloud. This morning it was better than usual. Hetty was a sound sleeper. Johnny always maintained it would take a shot of Dynagel to wake her. She never wore night clothes, and she never rose before 10:30 in the morning. She lay on her stomach, hugging a pillow to her chest, her hair a joyous tangle of flaming red against the green sheets. The morning was warm, and her blankets had been kicked aside. Davy stood in the passage. A nerve in his eyelid began to twitch, and under his shirt a drop of perspiration slid from his armpit down along his flank. On the bed, Hetty mumbled unintelligibly in her sleep, drew her knees up, and rolled slowly onto her back. One arm came up and flopped limply over her face. Her eyes were covered by the crook of her elbow. She sighed deeply. The twin mounds of her bosom were pulled out of shape by their own weight and the angle of her arm. The hair in her armpit and at the base of her belly was bright, shiny red gold. She was long and smooth and silky white, crowned and tipped with flame. She moved her body languorously, voluptuously, and then settled once more into slumber.
"Breakfast ready, master," the maid called from the kitchen.
Davy started guiltily and then retreated down the passage. He found with surprise that he was panting, as though he had run a long way.